Volpe versus Commonwealth. Mr. Boggs, good morning.
Good morning, Josh.
Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
Yes, sir, and you may begin whenever you're ready.
Your Honors, this is, well, may it please the Court, my name is Jeremy Boggs. I'm appearing as court-appointed counsel for Mr. Volpe. It's the appellant in this case.
Could you speak up just a little for me, please?
Yes, sir. My name is Jeremy Boggs. I'm appearing for Mr. Volpe, the appellant in this case. This is a constructive possession case. The wrinkle really is that this is constructive possession of a automatically cached digital image. So in the good old days, you, of course, took out your camera, snapped your photograph, the Polaroid came out, you grabbed that photograph and put that photograph in your pocket, you're in possession of it. You left that photograph back at your house, you may be in possession of it, depending on a constructive possession analysis that we're all familiar with. In the modern age, though, you instead take out your telephone, snap a picture on your telephone, put that telephone in your pocket. Certainly, if you take a photograph or download a photograph on your phone, put that phone in your pocket, you're in possession of it. What happened in this case, what we're talking about, the example here is, imagine instead that you open up your telephone or your computer and really looked at something or viewed something that was on the internet, such as a newspaper article or something like that, and there's a photograph in the newspaper article. You don't download the newspaper article, you don't save the newspaper article, you merely read it and close the newspaper article.
Well, counsel, I don't want to cut you short, but I mean, we read the record. Would you agree that what this case really comes down to is whether it's sufficient as a matter of law to show possession of child pornography to have images in your computer in the cache accessible only through a password, your password, and given the admission by your client that he views a lot of child porn by email. Now, as to the specific images, I mean, I guess the contention is, well, someone else might have had access to it. There's no evidence anybody really did specifically, but given the nature, the fact, I think there was some expert testimony that indicated that these photographs were somehow got in the cache. They were not stored on the hard drive. They were in the cache and got there through a thumb drive or an external drive that was connected. And given all of that, wouldn't it be, it certainly seems to support the concept that your client possessed them constructively. I understand the argument that was made at trial was that someone else might have had access and might have been the one to do it, but there's no evidence anyone did. But given the password protection and so forth, why isn't it enough as a matter of law for a fact finder to conclude that it's reasonable for your client to have had possession of it at some point?
Well, Judge, I think if you look at page 5 of the brief for the Commonwealth, per Investigator Olishay, the actual folders with the two images no longer existed. Olishay opined that the pornography was not stored on Volpe's computer, but was kept on an external device and then accessed on the computer. And again, on page 11, Olishay said the two images had to have been moved into folders to generate the image in the thumb cache, although the folders no longer existed. So what's happening in this case is that on April 1st, 2014, the day of the indictment, the day that the computers are seized by the police officer, those images don't exist on the computer in a normal sense. They only exist as a cached image on the computer. And when you're dealing with cached images, the Commonwealth is required to take a couple of additional steps to prove constructive possession. You have to show that the individual knew about this phenomenon, that the computer would automatically cache images, and prove that the individual had access to those images. Of course, access to those images requires some type of specialized knowledge about how computers work and possession of software to access these types of images.
Well, I think there's probably a lot of people that don't know how computers work, at least, you know.
Myself.
People are starting to discover that when you delete something from a computer, it's not really gone. But
that's correct. And there are some examples. If we look at the Tucker case, for instance, which is cited in the brief, that's a Tenth Circuit case. Mr. Tucker conceded that he knew these types of images were generated by the computer, and I think he also made some attempts to manually delete the images. Of course, deleting an image would indicate that he had control over that image, so the court's able to say that, at least in Mr. Tucker's case, he's guilty. Later in the Tenth Circuit, Mr. Dobbs, we get the opposite result. Mr. Dobbs says, well, I never knew about this. I never knew this was happening on the computer. I didn't know about this phenomenon. And Mr. Dobbs is not found to be in possession of any of this type of software. So Mr. Dobbs is found not guilty. In the Bass case, which is cited in the Dobbs case, there's a guilty finding. And what Mr. Bass had done is he had actually tried to destroy some of these images that were on his computer with a couple of computer programs, Window Washer and History Kill. And of course, having those computer programs attempting to destroy this residue of his illegal activity that remained on the computer, that indicated he had knowledge of it and indicated that he had control.
Well, what indicates your client had knowledge here is the fact that, it seems to me at least, is the fact that, first of all, you can't do anything with the computer, with this particular computer, without logging in with your username and password. According to the expert, his username and password was used to access this external drive at some point. Now, whether it was him or somebody who either had his username and password or had been given his username and password, I guess is open to debate. But nonetheless, it seems to be the reasonable inference, at a minimum, is that someone using the username David with the proper password plugged a thumb drive or an external drive of some sort, pulled up some kiddie porn, viewed it, deleted it, or at least unplugged the thumb drive so it wasn't there anymore, may or may not have realized that those images still remain in the cache under that username and ID. And the question is that sufficient as a matter of law to show actual or at least constructive possession, knowing possession of child pornography? Isn't that where we're at here?
Well, Judge, where that argument fails is the indictment. The indictment says April 1st, 2014. So the question
on or about, I assume.
On or about April 1st, 2014. So the question is, what was happening in 2014? Now, if you look at the Codman case, which is a case that came out after our trial and after our sentencing event, the fall of last year, it's a very similar case to this one. I think it's a... I can't make a distinction between the two cases myself when I read it. The Codman case, there's a quote here in the brief. While the evidence may suggest appellant at one time possessed the photographs in the unallocated space, there is no evidence that he had dominion or control of them on or about May 19, 2013, as the indictment is charged. So in this case, when those computers were seized on April 1st, the only thing that's there is this residue in the caching system of the computer. And in situations like that, Commonwealth has to take those two extra steps.
Well, is the analogy... doesn't the analogy go basically like this? I've got contraband. I know it's contraband. I put it in my pocket of my coat and forget about it. And a month later, it's still in my coat. I don't know. I'm not aware that it's still there, but I know I had it a month earlier. I was in possession of it a month earlier, but it's still in my coat. Do I still have possession of it, even though I'm not mentally aware that it's still in that coat pocket? Isn't that kind of the analogy we have here?
Well, Judge, I think what's happening is he is arrested on April 1st, and on April 1st, there's nothing in his coat pocket. Now, there's some circumstantial evidence that months prior, he may have had something in his coat pocket, but that day, April 1st, he's got nothing in his coat pocket.
Wasn't there testimony from the Commonwealth's investigator that the two images for which he was convicted were manipulated within the cache?
Well, the testimony was that those images had been manipulated, or they had been put into a file folder, downloaded and had been put into a file folder, and that file folder had been deleted, no longer existed on the computer. The image only existed on the computer on April 1st as a cached image.
But a cached image is basically a copy of the file, isn't it?
I think that would be accurate, yes. Yeah. It is. But the question is, does he know about the cached image? Does he know that it's there? Does he know how to...
Well, but the point is, he might not know it's there, but it is there. I mean, it's not like it's gone, really.
Well, that's correct. But if he doesn't know it's there, how can he be in possession of it?
Does a tree falling in the forest make any noise if no one's around to hear it? Is that the argument here, basically?
That's a whole other problem.
There was a question you asked the investigator, Olashe, question, and this appears on page 87 of the transcript, or excuse me, 75 of the transcript. Do you have any, was there any evidence that he ever accessed any of these images once they had been cached? Answer, once again, the images with the folders, yes. So there was testimony that they had been accessed once they'd been cached.
Judge, I think that he was responding yes to my question. I asked him,
was there any evidence that he ever accessed any of these images once they had been cached? And the answer is yes. Yes, sir.
75.
Page 75 of the transcript, it's listed as page 102 within the appendix. And it begins at line 1 and finishes at line 4.
The only thing that you were able to find was this automatically generated image. It's currently stored in the thumb cache. Answer, that's correct. Question. Okay, April 1st, those images are only in the thumb cache of the computer, nowhere else.
Now, see, I've got three different page numbers on my screen. I've got 87 in bold at the very bottom middle of the page. In the bottom left-hand corner, I've got page 102 of 301. In the top corner of the transcript, I've got page 75. Thank you very much. Isn't that question and that answer very problematic?
Well, I don't know that that's reflective exactly of what he was trying to say. There was some confusing testimony at that moment about what these things were.
But there was no follow-up beyond that, or no clarification. Just simply the answer yes to those ones with the folders.
Answers, in multiple places in the transcript, and I believe this is even stated in the Attorney General's brief. He answers that the only images that exist on the computer are the cached images.
I know, but when it gets to the allegation that the evidence was insufficient because it couldn't prove that he knew what was on the cache, much less paid any attention to it, doesn't that answer to question on cross-examination undercut that?
That answer was, as I said before, there was some confusion about in the question at that moment, and there were some more precise clarifying questions about what exactly was on the computer. There's multiple places where Mr. Olashe testified the only images they recovered were the cached images.
And I understand that, but again, the allegation is that there was insufficient evidence to establish that Mr. Volpe knew what was on the cache, much less had knowing possession of them. And that question, and more particularly the answer to that question, tends to undercut that, doesn't it? When the question is, was there any evidence that he ever accessed any of these images once they had been cached? And the answer was yes.
Well, that was not my understanding of the testimony, Judge. I might have to come back and revisit that on the phone.
Well, the way it works is you load a file from from anywhere, a hard disk or an external thumb drive, whatever. And it's automatic. The computer stores that file in a cache. It's a temporary storage area, and so it has quick access to it, and it stays there until the space is needed again by another file. I mean, that's what happened here. So, I guess again, if we're trying to analogize, it would be as if you made up a file folder, and somehow it got automatically duplicated into a second file folder that you didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And then you actively destroyed the first file folder thinking you've gotten rid of it, but the second file folder is still stuck in the back of your filing cabinet somewhere. The fact that you don't know it's there, does it make any difference in terms of whether you have possession of it or not?
Well, I think that's correct, Judge. I would say the second file folder is not stored in a place where a user can access it without knowledge.
Well, you can access it. All you got to do is call the file backup. And if it's in cache, it'll pull from the cache rather than from the other location because it'll load faster.
That would be a different example of what we have here, because the cached images you can't get to without the specialized software. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for you.
Yes, sir. We'll make sure you have a little extra time. Thank you.
evening, the court. Stephen Forster on behalf of the Commonwealth, the appellee in this case. I'll start by going to Judge Humphrey's first point. With respect to the evidence, the expert forensic examiner, Olajay, in this case, he specifically went through from pages 79 to 99 of the transcript, and he discusses exactly how this image was cached on this computer. And he goes through and he articulates that these two images that he's specifically discussing are different than the 12 that were stricken by the trial court judge because of the fact that they were able to be traced to where they came from. With respect to that, he says they specifically came from a thumb drive. I believe it's on page 97. You would have to have a copy of the image or download a copy, either directly into the folder or take an image you already have, copy it, and place it into that folder. I think that goes directly to your point of this possession of this image. And we also get into the testimony where Investigator May specifically states that they found these thumb drives in the defendant's bedroom. So that goes to the possession. He's got these thumb drives. And we have an expert, forensic and computer, saying that a thumb drive was plugged in, this folder was brought up, and that's how that folder and those images were then cached. So we do have this possession. We also have the testimony of the victim in this case saying at a certain point the defendant brought her into the bedroom and put in a thumb drive thingy into the computer and pulled up a video. And while I recognize the video was not the same as the photographs that he was convicted of, it's certainly circumstantial evidence supporting this possession of the contraband in question. Now, I think there's substantially greater evidence, we continue through the record, that is corroborative of this constructive possession. Again, we go to the admission of the defendant himself. He says, I receive a lot of emails containing child pornography, yet he doesn't explain, he deletes it, he doesn't say anything further, he just says, I get a lot of this pornography from my buddies in the Ukraine. As the Cobman Court stated, you can look at the number of images as circumstantial evidence of possession. In this particular case, we have 2,813 images that were consistent with child pornography found on the defendant's computer. To go back to your point, Judge Humphreys, about how these were associated with a name, we have a password-protected computer. It is testified by all the family members of the victim in this case that was solely within the purview of the defendant himself, and that all of the images were either associated with the user account David and or Kimba577HP, which the victim's mother testified was the other user account on the second computer for the defendant. We look at the case law and we discuss the constructive possession requirement, and again, we can go through and we look at all of these, again, that forensic expert, the testimony of the victim, and all of this builds up to this file folder that, like Judge Atlee just described, it says in the testimony was viewed after the fact. We have an after-the-fact viewing of this cache file folder, which goes to the sufficiency. I think when we look at the record as a whole, we look at the circumstantial evidence, we look at the facts, the direct evidence, as well as these cached images, it goes to prove that there was, in fact, constructive possession of image 2 and 3 in which he was convicted of. Now, I would like to address the defendant. He argues in great detail, citing to the case of Dobbs and Chapman and in Cobman, and I think they're all distinguishable. When we look at Dobbs, it goes through at great lengths to discuss that if a file is found, a picture is found solely in the cache of a computer, that in and of itself is insufficient. The Commonwealth wouldn't contest that. However, that's not what we have in this case. And in Dobbs, we also had the expert testifying there is no other evidence, repeatedly throughout the record, saying no other evidence other than an image, which again is in stark contrast to what we have in this case. When we look at Tucker, and we're looking at Tucker, Tucker came in and said, essentially admits to the police, I know that you can find what's in your search warrant on my computer. He admits that it's there, similar to the defendant in this case admitting that he gets emails fraught with child pornography. But he also indicates he knows about the cache and that he knows it was being saved. So it's distinguishable on those lines as well. But we get into the two core cases, the Cromer and Cobman line of cases that they discuss very much the same elements or the same circumstances that are presented in this case. But in fact, in this case, they're in much greater detail and there's many more. We talk about the name association. user accounts, the user passwords, the name associations, and the link files to those user accounts are indicative of constructive possession. Again, going back to the number of photographs, look at the number and the presence of those photographs. We look at search history on a computer to show that it's indicative of this possession of child pornography. In this particular case, forensic expert Olshay testified that he found 9 link files looking at uncensored sex with children, again, going to this constructive possession. And I think the strongest point was made by Judge Atlee is that it's in the record. It says, was it accessed after it was cached? And it says it is. There's no follow-up there. The court doesn't have any questions for the Commonwealth. Rely on the brief and the arguments that have been made and ask the court to affirm the convictions.
Thank you, Mr. Forster. Mr. Boggs, and we're going to add 2 minutes to your time.
Thanks, sir. Well, I think, you know, the Commonwealth makes a good argument about this, you know, circumstantial evidence of possession. I think the problem that the Commonwealth runs into is when did that possession take place? These images were not date-touched in that time, so they were never able to determine when these images appeared on the computer screen. In fact, some of them did. So they were forced to rely instead upon the seizure date of the computer, which is April 1st, and again, that runs us right back into this issue about what was actually there on April 1st, and the only thing being there is the cached images.
Well, didn't the 2000 amendment to the statute address that issue when it said that including cached images stored on the computer?
Well, Judge, I believe that is part of the definition of an explicit image, I believe, in the statute knew prior to the...
But I think the point is it includes cached images no matter when they were created.
Well, sure, I think they can be defined. There. They can be defined as being, you know, cached images, but the question is still whether or not you possess the image. If it qualifies...
Well, I think it takes it to the knowing image, but it takes care of the possession on that date. Because if a cached image is part of that, then it eliminates the on or about being an issue, does it not?
I would interpret that to mean, you know, this is the definition of what this image is, you know, what kind of image it could be, whether it's a digital image or some other type of image, and then we fall into the question of possession, constructive possession, whether or not you possess it on April 1st.
Well, it says a digital image, including such material stored on a computer's temporary internet cache, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Correct. That's what the statute reads. But again, my interpretation would be, you know, a question of did he possess that image, that cached image on April 1st? I think that's still a live question. Certainly a question in the Cobden case last fall, which again, I believe is a very similar case to this one.
Well, if it's on the computer, he possessed it. The issue is whether or not he knowingly possessed it, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Did you?
No.
Regarding I believe that covers it. Give me a second of the questions. I'm happy to try to answer them.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel.
Can we take a break?
Yes. And then following that, we'll take a brief recess.
Okay.